Welcome to True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to part two of the murder of Petra Nel and Issy Fourie. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I highly recommend you do that first and come back here for part two. In part one of this episode, I discussed the murder of Petra Nel and Issy Fourie. We looked at the evidence left behind by the killer or killers, and I introduced you to the three families involved in the victim's side of this crime: the Nels, the Fouries, and the Fouchiers. We left the families in the 1960s, with their lives forever changed, and each member having to deal not only with grief, but also the anger and frustration of not knowing who had committed this horrendous crime. As the years crept by without answers, the members of the families did their best to move forward with life. Dries and Mari Fourie had moved back to Zambia soon after the murders, but returned to South Africa in 1973. André Fourie, who'd made a vow to his sister at her graveside that he would find her killer, had left his dreams of becoming a doctor behind and joined the South African police. Over the years, he worked his way up through the ranks and became a well-respected detective. But his personal life often suffered under the continued weight of guilt and grief. André regularly looked at different ways to approach the most important case in his life. And although over the years the docket would be pulled out and re-examined, these reinvestigations often led nowhere, and André would find himself back in a deep pit of despair. As a result, he turned to alcohol, and his drinking and obsession with his sister's case negatively impacted his personal relationships. André would marry twice, and he had children with his first wife. Throughout the late 60s, 70s, and early 80s, though, a suitcase in his closet was never far from his mind. It was Izzy's school case, the brown one she'd written her name on, and now, instead of being filled with school books and the tokens of teenagehood, André had filled it with clippings from newspapers, a video recording his father had made of the crime scene, and reams of notes André had made about the case and possible perpetrators over the years. In 1975, Henning Nel passed away without ever knowing who had killed his daughter and niece. Osis Nel, now alone in a huge house in Oudendalsrus, moved in with her daughter Henda, who had, by that time, married and had children of her own. The other Nel children had also married and started their own families. Each one of the new children born into the Nel, Fourie, and Fouchier families would at some point hear about their long-lost relatives. They would also, unknowingly for the most part, live with the legacy of what those murders and the ongoing uncertainty had done to their parents, grandparents, and aunts and uncles. Violent crime in a family changes the way future generations parent. There's absolutely no way around that. I've seen it time and again when I have the privilege of speaking with victims of crime and their families. Even when there is justice, the crime sends ripples out into future generations without fail. Sometimes that looks like small adjustments, like parents being more protective, occasionally overly so, with their own children. Sometimes those ripples look like substance use disorders, especially alcoholism. Sometimes it means people find it difficult to form lasting relationships or bonds, because subconsciously, they think if they don't love anyone else, they'll never again suffer the deep grief of loss. One victim told me that she doesn't ever appear in family pictures with her children because she is ashamed of the physical scars she still carries from an attack decades before, which had killed her mother and almost killed her. In the same breath, she laments the fact that she herself has no photographs of her own mother, who simply didn't like the camera and was always behind it instead of in the frame. The Fashia family suffered as secondary victims to this crime. The cloud of suspicion over Gustav remained through the 70s and early 80s, and his use of alcohol to dull that pain deeply impacted his family. I'll talk a little later about future generations of the Fashia family and how really they were able to bring this whole very sad situation full circle. Because that is the other side of this coin. Violent crime does send trauma through generations, but there are also individuals within families who can and do turn that trauma around and break the cycle. In 1981, Petro and Issy's case was shown on a television program at the time called Police File. The show at the time was used to bring public awareness to criminals on the run and also to older cold cases, like that of the girls. The show was really good at bringing in new tips and leads on cases, and that happened in 1981 with Petro and Issy's case too. Andre kept his ears and eyes open around this time, but he was well aware of one important thing. If he was going to get justice for his sister, he could not get too close to an investigation that actually brought the perpetrator to justice. As much as he wanted to work the case and identify the person himself, he knew very well that if it came to court, evidence could be questioned because he was the brother and cousin of the victims. So he walked a really fine line around this time, maintaining awareness of new information, doing what he could to investigate leads on his own, but always ensuring that he handed over the baton if things ever got too close to an arrest. It must have been incredibly frustrating for him, but he knew it was necessary if he was to keep his promise to Issy. Ultimately, it would be his work as a police officer, albeit not entirely directly, which would lead to the most important lead of all. In 1983, Andre received a tip-off from a man who had been previously incarcerated. The man had actually been arrested by Andre and felt that Andre had treated him so well that when he came across some information he thought the police officer would be interested in, he decided to reach out. The information had come from someone who was still behind bars in Zonnewater Correctional Facility, 40 kilometres north of Pretoria. In a letter he'd written to his previous cellmate, he began with a standard communication of how life behind bars was going, but then the man told him that he had a new cellmate who'd said something quite disturbing. The man had claimed that in 1966, he, his brother and his cousin had been responsible for the now infamous rapes and murders of two 12-year-old girls. The girls were Petro and Issy. The man making the claims was called Johan David Hans Tudon. He is alternately referred to as both Johan and Hans, but most frequently as Hans, so that's what I'll call him. And as I've introduced you to three families already, I now introduce you to a fourth, the Tudons. The Tudon family had lived for most of their lives in a farming town called Boshoff, which is 189 kilometres and about a two-hour drive from Odendaalsrus. The family was well known in the small town, but for all the wrong reasons. Tiron Sr., the patriarch of the family, was a known alcoholic and criminal. He and his wife had 12 children, but not all of those children would grow up with the family throughout their childhood. At least one of the Tiron children is believed to have passed away under suspicious circumstances. The investigation of which eventually led to the discovery of deeply abusive behaviours in the household and the removal of several of the younger children, who then grew up in state care. The older Tiron children remained behind to their detriment. Among them was Barent Tiron, who'd suffered severe damage to his right hand as a child. As a result, his hand was permanently disfigured and unusable, and Barent wore a black glove over the hand. He'd gained the nickname Swarthand because of this. Barent was known as a rather reclusive character and seemed troubled. He and his younger brother Hans spent a lot of time together and seemed to be quite closely bonded. Despite their troubled childhood, both Hans and Barent still appeared connected with their father. In 1966, they were still living in Borsov with their parents, but often travelled to visit other family members across the country. In January of that year, Hans was 15 years old, and Barent was 18. Both boys used alcohol and dacha regularly and were already committing petty crimes, although neither of them had been arrested or convicted for anything at that point. The cousin that Hans had referred to was Diederik Steenkamp. He'd often spent time with Barent and Hans at that point and claimed to be living with his aunt in Elsberg in 1966. Many of the older Tiron siblings maintained contact with each other over the years, and one sister would later recount how she'd watched Barent's mental health go into a downward spiral over the years. He allegedly suffered from terrible nightmares throughout his life and self-medicated with alcohol and drugs. In 1975, Barent attempted to drown himself in a water silo on a farm. He was saved just in time. Then, on the 31st of December 1976, Barent, Hans's girlfriend, and two of their sisters were in a hotel room in Bloemfontein celebrating the new year, when Barent had suddenly stood up, walked to the hotel room window, swung it open, and jumped out head first. Barent Tiron sustained severe injuries but did not die immediately. He was taken to a local hospital and passed away there a few days later. Hans's life after 1966 had swung into constant criminality. By the time he turned 16, he had his first criminal conviction for theft. After that, he was in and out of prison, regularly racking up a three-page-long criminal record by the time he came to André Fourie's attention. Hans's personal relationships had also gone poorly. When he was 20 years old, he'd gotten into a relationship with a wealthy 65-year-old widow. After months of Hans living with the woman and exhibiting clear abuse and control, her family eventually managed to convince her to break things off with the young man. Hans had also been briefly married to a young woman from a wealthy family. The family had been against the relationship from day one, and after Hans became incredibly abusive and violent toward her, they were able to get the marriage annulled, and the young woman virtually went into hiding to get away from Hans. When André received the information from the informant, as tempting as it may have been to run with it himself, he did the right thing and went to the most recently appointed investigating officer on Petro and Izzy's case. He wanted to help, he said, but he would take his lead from the IO, as what he really wanted was justice. Andre would be allowed to assist in the investigation, but only under the supervision of the IO, and soon they were on the road to Borsov to figure out who this Hans Teron really was. Simultaneous to this, the man who'd written the letter to the informant was brought in. This had to be done very carefully to avoid tipping off Hans Teron. Slowly, they managed to get the man on side to help them to get more information out of Teron. Soon, the operation became incredibly time-sensitive, as officers discovered that Hans, who was serving a 4-year sentence for housebreaking, would be released from prison very soon. Although the man would still be under parole conditions, his record showed that he'd breached parole many times before, and the police suspected that if they were not able to arrest him before he was released, if he had even the slightest inkling he was being looked at for the murders, he would flee, and they would probably never see him again. The more the police looked at Hans Teron and his brother Barent, the more they believed that they finally had their men. The presence of a third man had never been fully discounted, so Teron's allegation that his cousin Steenkamp had been involved could also fit. One of the main concerns was the age of the men in 1966. The Terons were teenagers. Hans was just 15. Steenkamp would have been 24, so if they went with the theory that he was involved, perhaps he had been the leader of the pack, and the other two had followed along, they thought. The letter B scratched into the hair comb found at the scene fit Barrett. The initials on the wall were still a bit of a mystery, though. Through the years, a theory had developed that perhaps when asked their names, Petro had not wanted to tell the men her real name, if she thought at the time that they would be released. So she said the first name that sprung to mind. Although her parents had clarified that she'd never called herself Yvonne, one of the girls in the extended family did occasionally call herself that. So it's possible Petro had blurted out that name, and perhaps the girls had either told the men or the men had assumed that they were sisters. And if they knew Petro's surname was Null, perhaps they'd thought Izzy's surname was also Null. Those theories would account for the YN and the IN. As for the third set of initials, HF, it was not impossible that Hans Teron had either written badly enough that his T looked somewhat like an F, or that he thought about how wholly unintelligent it would be to leave his real initials at the scene of a double rape and murder. Another element that fit Hans's involvement was the redhead sighting. Hans Teron was a natural redhead, or a ginger, if you will. In reviewing all of the leads they'd received over the last decades, there'd also been one single mention of a sighting of a man with a black hand in Urdendal's Riss that day. At the time, it had made no sense, and police had no idea what to do with the information. Now, in the context of Baron Teron, it made complete sense. With some more information coming out from Zonnewater, as Hans leaked little bits of information to his cellmate, Andre and his fellow officers became more and more certain that they had their man. For the most part, people had believed that the initials on the wall had been drawn in blood. It was a story that police had allowed to continue on without correcting, because very few people knew the truth at that time. and that could one day help them to identify the real killer. And it did exactly that, when the informant came back with a story from Tarun about how the initials on the wall had been drawn in lipstick and not blood. During this time, Andre was put in a very difficult position. As much as he wanted to share with his family and the Nulls that they may be about to break the case open, he couldn't. Everything had to stay under wraps until they'd made an arrest. As Hans Tarun's release date drew near, police made a decision not to arrest him while he was in prison. They didn't want word getting out that he'd been arrested for a crime he'd confessed to a fellow cellmate about, as that would put the informant in a very precarious position. So the decision was made to wait for his release date and then arrest him as he stepped foot outside Zonavata. And that is exactly what happened. In March 1984, almost 20 years after Petra Null and Issy Faree were raped and murdered, Andre Faree, accompanied by other officers, watched Hans Tarun walk out of the gates of the prison. He had the smile and the skip in his step of a free man. But that lasted for about 30 seconds, as Andre Faree stepped forward, called Tarun's name, identified himself as a police officer, and snapped cuffs around Tarun's wrists as he recited the charges against him and explained his rights. Izzy's big brother had kept his promise. At the same time as Tarun was being arrested, Diederik Steenkamp, who had already been released from prison but was under surveillance, was also taken into custody. In the next few hours, the Null, Faree and Fushia families were advised of the arrests, and Andre was able to share some information with them about the two suspects and the deceased third suspect. The families had experienced the elation of arrests before, though, only to be let down. But with Andre being so sure that they had the right people this time, they allowed themselves to think that, possibly, this could be the moment they'd all been wishing for so long. Newspaper headlines the next day brought the two 12-year-old girls back into the public domain, as journalists, some who'd covered the original investigation and others who knew nothing about the case, delivered the news that two suspects had been arrested and brought the reading public up to date with what had occurred two decades before. Hans Tarun did not seem at all put out that he'd been arrested. Everyone who spoke with him said he was calm and collected, and quite quickly agreed that he would plead guilty to all the charges against him. Diederik Steenkamp, on the other hand, claimed to be horrified that he would be accused of such a crime and insisted he was innocent. By the time Tarun got access to some legal advice, though, he changed his mind and said he would only plead guilty to one count of rape. And by the time the pretrial proceedings started, the judge would end up changing that plea for him to one of not guilty, because the story Tarun told sounded very much like he was under coercion, and therefore the judge said he wanted the state to prove its case in order to counter that possibility of coercion. The story that Hans Tarun told the court that day was that on the 10th of January 1966, he, his brother Barend, and his cousin Diederik Steenkamp had been driving through Odendalsris on their way to Elsberg. He said they'd been drinking and smoking dacha while they drove, and around 3 p.m. they drove past the swimming pool and saw two girls walking down the road. He claimed they'd pulled over and asked the girls, who he now knew to be Petra Null and Issy Faree, if they wanted a lift home. He says the girls had agreed and gotten into the car with them. Hunt said that Barnes had, despite being given directions by the girls to their home, driven onto a dirt road and headed for the abandoned building. The girls had become afraid and told him that that was the wrong way. Barnes had said that they were just going for a quick drive and then they'd take them home. Hunt said that Barnes had parked behind the building so that their car wouldn't be visible from the road, and they'd forced the now terrified girls from the car. Inside the building, Barnes had instructed the girls to remove their clothes. They refused, so Barnes had then instructed Hunt to remove their clothes. He told his brother to pull down some electrical wiring from the ceiling and bind the girls' hands. At this point, Hunt said that Steenkamp had taken Petra upstairs where he believed he had raped her, and he and his brother had raped Essie downstairs. Afterwards, he claimed he thought that they were going to leave the girls there alive, but then his brother had pulled out his gun, and Hunt realised the girls were going to be shot, so he'd run out to the car. He then heard gunshots and assumed that his brother had shot the girls. Diederich Steenkamp entered not guilty pleas to all of the charges against him and insisted that he was never at the scene and had absolutely nothing to do with the crimes. After this initial hearing, the state seemed to reconsider their position. With Barend Tiron now confirmed as deceased and Hunt claiming he was just a teenager who'd been controlled by his brother, they feared that they would not have enough evidence to prove that Hunt had been involved in the murders. They were still actively investigating other avenues which could lead to more information on the murder charges, though, so at that time, they decided to withdraw the murder charges against Hunt, as well as the rape charge for Petra. As they'd considered Hunt's story, it really didn't seem very likely that they would have enough evidence to convict Steenkamp on anything at that point, so all of the charges against him were withdrawn and he was allowed to go free. When this was announced in court, Tiron's face had broken out into a broad grin and he'd elbowed Steenkamp. It was very bizarre behaviour, and the reason for it, or at least the claimed reason at that point, would be revealed in the next court hearing. With Steenkamp now released, Hunt Tiron told the court that he had wanted to amend his story because he had lied about Steenkamp being involved. He said with his brother dead, he hadn't wanted to stand against the charges alone, so he'd pulled his hapless cousin in. Although his new story was quite similar to the first, it now excluded a third person, and he additionally claimed that Barnes had actually forced him to undress and bind the girls at gunpoint. He said Barnes had taken Petra upstairs and he'd raped Izzy downstairs. Throughout his statements, Hunt had referred to the rapes as sex, and when he was finished, the judge had asked him to clarify whether by sex he actually meant rape, and Hunt confirmed that this is what he meant. Hunt did tell the court that although he was young and under the influence of substances, he did know what he was doing, and he was capable of not doing it. Even though a not guilty plea had been entered, Hunt had admitted to raping Izzy, and therefore what the state had to prove was not that he'd committed the act, but that he did so knowingly and willingly. While these proceedings were ongoing, the investigation continued in the background. Essentially, what the police wanted was to secure a rape conviction against Tiron and then find more evidence to ensure that they could get a conviction for murder too. One of the ways they'd hoped to do this was by finding a woman who Barend Tiron had been dating in 1972. After speaking to one of the Tiron sisters, police had figured out that Barend Tiron may have confessed his involvement in the murders to this woman. The reason they thought this is that Barrent had told his sister shortly before his suicide attempts that he was being blackmailed by a woman who had information that could ruin his life. Police partnered with the media in an attempt to find the woman and published articles requesting that the woman come forward. They also asked the owner of a .22-caliber pistol, whose gun had been stolen in Elsberg the year before the murders, to come forward. It appeared that Barrent had gotten his gun by stealing it, and police desperately wanted to try and prove that Barrent had stolen it, so that they could put a gun of that caliber in his hands, so to speak. Hunts claimed not to know what caliber the gun had been. This continued on in the background, while the families returned to court each day to hear what the outcome would be in the rape case against Hans Tiron. During these court proceedings, several incidents occurred, which, although not legal and more social in nature, made it into the newspapers and are certainly worth noting. A few weeks into Tiron's arrest, as his case made the news, a 21-year-old girl began appearing at his court hearings. It soon emerged that this young lady had read about Hans in the newspaper and seen a mention that he didn't have any family visiting him, so she decided to start visiting him in prison. The pair later claimed to journalists that they'd immediately fallen in love, and the young woman believed that Hans was simply a misguided youth when he'd committed his crime, and she didn't see him as a rapist. She further said that no matter what sentence he got, she would stand by him and wait for him, as long as it took. Despite Tiron's claims of having no family support, one of his sisters did attend the proceedings with her husband. Her husband had epilepsy, and during one hearing the man collapsed and suffered a seizure. Members of the Fischer family later recalled how it had been Gustav, the man who for so many years had suffered under a cloud of suspicion and had every reason to hate the Tirons, who had jumped in first to help, as everyone else stood and stared. When Gustav was later asked by a journalist why he'd helped, he seemed shocked at the question. "He's a human being. You must help," he said. In almost every picture of Hans Tiron on trial from that time, he has a broad smile on his face, and he's making direct eye contact with a photographer. His posture is relaxed, and those who spoke with him described him as charming, well-spoken, and engaging. Looking at those pictures, one would have no idea the man was on trial for the rape of a 12-year-old girl, which had ended in her and her cousin's murder. After weeks of desperate pleas for Barrent's ex-girlfriend to come forward, in May that year, the woman finally presented herself to a police station in KwaZulu-Natal, where she was living. She confirmed that she had been in a relationship with Barrent Tiron for several years, but denied knowing anything about the girl's murders. She also denied having blackmailed Barrent at all. Unfortunately, we don't know what else this woman was able to tell police or what they may have asked. I would have liked to have known what the dynamic was between Barrent and his brother, for starters. And honestly, just because this woman denies knowing anything doesn't mean she didn't. To admit that she knew and did nothing would not look good for her at all. Additionally, to admit to blackmailing Barrent would mean that she was admitting to a crime herself. I'm sure the police would have offered her immunity from prosecution for any information she had, but maybe she just didn't want to get involved. Or maybe Barrent's addled mind had made it all up as a delusion of persecution. In October 1984, Hans Tiron was found guilty of the rape of Issy Furie and sentenced to 10 years in prison. The judge had had a difficult sentencing decision to make in that Tyrone was a minor at the time of the crime, but he was sentencing him as an adult who had gone on to commit many more crimes, although admittedly none of what he'd been convicted of were violent crimes. Tyrone had expressed that although he took responsibility for what he had done to Essie that day, he also begged for mercy in sentencing because he claimed to have been wholly led by his brother. He expressed remorse and asked for the family's forgiveness. Osis Null, who'd been supported by her adult children throughout the court process, later told journalists that she felt conflicted over what had transpired. She said that she had grandchildren who were the same age now as Tyrone was when he'd committed his crimes, and she could see how they too might make poor decisions under the control of someone older than them. After the sentence was handed down, Dries Ferrie approached Tyrone and stuck out his hand for a handshake. His final words to the man who had so deeply changed his family's life forever were, "Young man, I hope you come out of this a better person." As Hans Tyrone was led to the transportation that would take him to prison to begin serving his sentence, the Null, Ferrie and Fushia families left the court. Photographers snapped pictures of them leaving, hand in hand, and news cameras filmed this long-awaited moment of what should be closure. Hans Tyrone's seeming remorse and his claims that he was being controlled by his brother perhaps allayed some of their pain around there being no murder convictions and no sentence at all for Petra. I'm sure that at that moment, the future seemed just a little bit brighter. This long-awaited chapter was finally over, and they could move forward somehow, at the very least knowing what really happened on that terrible day. But that would not be the case. And it soon became clear that Hans Tyrone's remorse was perhaps not entirely authentic. Within days of his sentencing, Tyrone applied to appeal his sentence. He argued that a 10-year sentence would not have been handed down to a 15-year-old in 1966, and therefore he was being treated unfairly because he'd only been caught almost 20 years later. Around this time, too, police admitted that it seemed unlikely they would ever be able to charge anyone with the murders in this case. They'd pinned their hopes on Barent's ex-girlfriend for the most part, and they'd also had no luck in figuring out where the murder weapon had originally come from. But although the murder charges seemed awash, they and the prosecution were working behind the scenes on something else that might secure some more time for Tyrone in prison. But first, his appeal needed to play out. In 1985, Hans Tyrone's case appeared before an appeal court. The appeal judges found that Tyrone's capacity as a minor at the time of the crime was taken into sufficient account when he was initially sentenced. However, concern existed that the sentence may have been formed unfairly, because Tyrone's criminal history after the crime against Essie was taken into account in formulating the sentence. Although in sentencing, judges are definitely allowed to take the offender's criminal history into account to determine whether they think there's a possibility of rehabilitation, in this case's context, the appeal judges felt it may have been unfair to do so. They said that if Tyrone had been sentenced in 1966, the judge at that time could have no idea that he would go on to have a long criminal history after that. And essentially, the judge in 1984 was given the benefit of seeing Tyrone's actions thereafter and using that to influence the sentence he handed down. Because of this, The appeal court reduced Tarun's sentence to 6 years. Now, while I understand the reasoning behind this, I think one pretty major factor has been ignored. Yes, Hans Tarun was only convicted and sentenced almost 20 years after the fact. But that was because he chose to hide his involvement and not come forward. Although he claimed his brother had told him not to say anything about the crimes, he also said that after this happened, they drifted apart. So he clearly wasn't under his brother's influence anymore. He had the opportunity to be sentenced as a minor, but didn't take it. And even if he was afraid of his brother, Boren died in 1977. He had the opportunity to come forward then too, and chose not to do that either. With Tarun's sentence significantly reduced, the background activities by the police and prosecution shifted into high gear. It emerged that despite Tarun confirming that his cousin was not involved in the crime, his claims of a third man's involvement had not ended there. As he was being tried for the rape, police were working on another claim Tarun had made. Tarun had accused a doctor, who he said lived near Oerdendaal's Rus, but had been struck off the medical roll for unknown reasons, of being the third perpetrator in the crime. These accusations had gone so far that police had actually arrested this man and held him in custody. They were eventually able to establish that the doctor had not been anywhere near Oerdendaal's Rus in 1966, and he was released. But the police now saw this as an opportunity to keep Tarun behind bars for a longer period. And in 1987, they brought Tarun to trial on charges of perjury and fraud. The perjury charge was for making the false claim in an official statement, and the fraud charge was for identifying the doctor in question in an identification lineup after the man's arrest. This trial would only present further questions in this case, because while pleading guilty to perjury and fraud, Hans Tarun made further statements that brought his entire first version into question. He claimed that he had initially made the false claims against both Steenkamp and the doctor because he was protecting his father. Now Hans Tarun was claiming that there were indeed three perpetrators that day. Him, his brother Barent, and his father, Johan Tarun Sr. And in fact, he said that he actually hadn't raped Izzy at all. He'd stayed in the car the whole time, and it was his father and Barent who had committed the crimes. He claimed he had only admitted to being involved to protect his father. And if you're thinking, well, okay, I hope they went and arrested the dad, because then they could bring the murder charges and get Petro some justice too. Unfortunately, that could not happen, because Tarun Sr. had died in 1986. Rather conveniently for Hans, who could now shape an entire narrative around two dead men, which completely vindicated him. Thankfully, the trial judge on the perjury and fraud case was not having it, and he handed down a 4-year sentence to Tarun to be served consecutively to his original rape sentence. This meant, despite his appeal, he was back up to 10 years. And with that, the families could really now try to move forward with whatever sense of closure the debacle had brought. Although in some ways they sort of knew what happened, they would always have to wonder what the real story actually was. In the years that followed, South Africa changed a lot as a country, and each member of the families moved forward with their lives in different ways. On the day that Hans Tarun was sentenced, André Fourie went to his sister's grave and delivered the news that he'd kept his promise. It would be easy to think that now that he'd completed the task he'd been focused on for so long, Andre could move on to a more relaxed and less tumultuous chapter of his life. But very often, when someone carries around this heavy a burden with them, it becomes part of their identity. The mission can become the thing that pushes down the dark emotions. And when the mission is completed, you have to figure out who you are without that. Andre Faree was an incredible police officer, a loving brother and son, and despite his challenges, his children loved him deeply. Andre Faree died in 2010 of cancer. By then, he'd remarried, and his second wife loved and nursed him until his last days on earth. Before he died, Andre handed over Izzy's brown school case to his son. It was a tragic inheritance for the young man receiving it at the time, and he knew well enough how much it meant to his father that Izzy and Petro never be forgotten. The murder of the two girls had become such a defining moment in all the families that even those who had never met them understood their responsibility to guarding their memory. There are many weird coincidences in this case. I'll tell you about another one later on, but Andre wasn't the only person in this case who died in 2010. Although it was incredibly difficult to find proper information about what had happened to Hans Teron after he was released from prison, from records found, it seems quite certain that he too died in 2010. Some sources indicate that he may have been living in Krugersdorp at the time. There's unfortunately no record of what happened between his release in the 90s and when he died in 2010. I'll talk a bit more later about my theories around Teron's criminal career, both before and after his conviction in this case. In 1996, Osis Nell passed away. She'd lived with her daughter, Henda, for most of her life after her husband had passed away, and in the last few years of her life, her health was very poor, and Henda cared for her permanently during that time. I don't have any information about Dries and Mari Faree, but considering their ages, I think it's safe to assume they too would have passed away by now. The younger generations of the Nell, Faree and Fushia families, however, live on with the childhoods, memories and context created on the 10th of January 1966. And it would be a member of the more recent generation of the Fushia family who would go on to bring this case, in many ways, full circle. Poppy, who was just 6 years old when her cousins were murdered, went on to marry and have children of her own. One of those children is called Willem van der Merwe. Back in 1984, when Hans Teron was on trial for the rape of Issy Faree, Willem was 5 years old. He clearly recalls sitting on the couch with his mom and dad, watching the news, and being incredibly confused when he saw his family on the television. The shot was of the Nells, Farees and Fushias walking down the steps of the courthouse after Teron's sentencing. He understood then that there was something he didn't know about his family. Something pretty big. And in bits and pieces over the years, when he was old enough to understand, he would hear the story of the two murdered cousins, whose deaths had so deeply shaped his own life in many ways. As the pieces of the puzzle fell into place, he started to better understand his grandparents, Max and Gustav too, and the struggles they had experienced. The story of the two young girls always sat in the back of Willem's mind. And as someone whose own journey to becoming a storyteller in various forms has clearly been shaped by my own personal and family experiences with tragic tales, I was in no way surprised that Willem had become a storyteller as an adult. As a producer, Willem had worked in film and audio storytelling in various capacities over the years. And after working on a rather well-known South African podcast series, My Only Story with Dion Wiggett, the cogs in his brain started to turn about that old family story. It would be in 2020, during the pandemic though, that Willem really sat down and started to think about how he could bring this tragic story back to life and honour Petro and Issy. Of course, he first needed to see how the surviving family members would feel about it, and so he started to make phone calls, and when travel was allowed, visits to the various people I've mentioned throughout these two episodes. At first, Willem thought the story would make a good podcast series. I mean, I agree. But when he contacted André Fourie's son and he was handed Izzy's school case with all that imagery inside it, it suddenly dawned that the story would best be told in a visual format. Between 2020 and 2025, Willem and a team of other producers, creators, directors, and researchers took a deep dive into the lives and deaths of two 12-year-old girls from 1966. And a script was born for the CakeNet series that has just graced our screens, Nuggies. Oh, and before I go any further down this path, I must tell you about another one of those weird coincidences. So it turns out that when Barend Theron died in 1977, he passed away 3 days after the 11-year anniversary of the girls' murders, by the way, some of his organs were donated. Now, I don't know exactly how it worked in those days, if they had to get permission from the family or not. I think I'm correct in assuming that Barend Theron was not a registered organ donor, if such a thing even existed back then. But Barend was also eventually buried as a so-called pauper and without any gravestone. So I do wonder if perhaps in those circumstances, the state had the right to harvest organs for transplant. I don't know. And anyway, it probably doesn't matter. What does matter is that Barend's kidneys ended up being transplanted into two men. And those transplants were only the second and third organ transplants ever undertaken in Bloemfontein. If we assume that Hans Theron's story is true, and his brother really was a rapist and murderer, that seems a small and sweet twist of fate. The man who had taken two lives ended up, unknowingly, saving two as well, after taking his own. But that's actually not the weirdest coincidence in this. Even stranger than that is when Willem started really digging into the story in 2020, he figured out that his next-door neighbour was a relative of the surgeon who had performed the transplants of Barend's kidneys into the two men. Yes, I know. I love my rabbit holes, don't I? Back to Willem bringing the cousin's stories to the screen. So what you've watched over the last several weeks on television is really a culmination of 59 years of pain, grief, hope, persistence, tragedy, and now legacy. Because almost six decades after Petro and Izzy took their last walk to the swimming pool, after a brother racked with guilt that was not his to bear, stood at a graveside and vowed to never forget. Thousands of viewers across the country have gotten to know the girls. We've witnessed the devastation, that violent crime brings to a family. And we truly see now how, even 6 decades later, its impact remains. Willem admits that the unanswered questions that remain around this case still frustrate him and his family. And I think that's completely understandable. They got the truth, but they also didn't. But they also got far more truth than many families get. Although I think it's not fair to insist they feel grateful for that, because there's no level of gratitude required in a situation like this. It's something, I guess. And I have no doubt they'd rather have that something than nothing at all. So let's chat a bit about what we know and what we don't know. There's no doubt that Hans Tedon was involved in this crime to some extent. That is a very big tick mark. But in his statement, he leaves so much open to interpretation, and then he goes and changes it so many times, it's difficult to know what the truth really is. For starters, how did Petro and Izzy even end up in the car with them? Everyone who knew the girls doubted that they would have gotten into the car with someone they didn't know. In the early stage of the investigation, this was also a line of inquiry that had the police thinking that one of the men in the car may have been known to either Petro or Izzy. Now, because Izzy had been in South Africa for such a short time, it's unlikely she knew either of them. So perhaps it had been someone Petro had known. Sadly, this is another reason that Gustav Verschier was so strongly suspected, because the girls would easily have gotten into his car. But knowing what we know now, that Hans and Barend Tedon were in the car, and possibly a third man, what are the odds that Petro would have known either of those young men? In all fairness, Hans and Barend were moving in very different circles to Petro. She wasn't a girl who went to parties or really would have run into the Tedon brothers socially. But it's not impossible that Petro had seen either brother around town and so vaguely recognized them enough to feel comfortable enough for a short car ride. We have to take into account that Barend Tedon seemed to know exactly where the abandoned Freddy's South building was. And for him to know that, he would have to have some decently intimate knowledge of Odendaal's Rus. Of course, there's another possibility, that neither girl had ever seen the brothers before, but the fact that Hans was 15 years old, just 3 years older than the girls, lulled them into a false sense of security. This kind of thing has happened many times with predators. They will use younger people or women to get their victims to set their guard down. Because only older men are dangerous, right? Not women or teenagers. As a teenager, you would never think of someone your own age as being a danger to you. So maybe that is what happened. Because the witness who said they saw the girls getting into a car didn't say they were being forced. So maybe the girls figured it was safe because the young men were so young. I can certainly picture myself thinking that way at that age. And we know that the witness definitely did see what they said they did, because it turned out they correctly identified the colour of the vehicle. The make was slightly off, but the colour was spot on. And so we have to consider the other part of their statement, and the part that Hans Tedon seemed so set on keeping shrouded in mystery, the third man. In the days after the girls' murders, no one had any idea how many perpetrators there'd been. There was some evidence that pointed to three, but none of the news articles I read from that time gave much certainty to the public around that point. But again, even if there was a third older man in the vehicle, the fact that there were also two young people close to their ages could have set Petro and Izzy at ease enough to get into the car. I think it's fair to say for sure that Diedrich Steenkamp was not that third man. Hans pulled him into the story from the moment he was arrested, though. So why would he do that? Why would he think he needed to do that? I don't quite believe his story about just not wanting to stand trial on his own. That sounds far-fetched. You throw your own cousin under the bus for a horrendous crime he didn't commit just because you didn't want to stand in court on your own. Not likely, in my opinion. I think that Hans Terdoorn believed he would need a third man to include in his story, because perhaps he thought police had evidence of a third man on the scene. After almost 20 years, Hans Terdoorn had to know that policing and investigation techniques had improved significantly. And perhaps he thought that some of the evidence they left behind all those years ago could be used differently in the 80s to identify the presence of three distinct perpetrators. Police couldn't really prove that, though. But Hans didn't know that when he confessed initially. His second man, Barent, was dead. And dead men tell no tales. So instead of pointing to the real third perpetrator, maybe he just made one up. And I personally think that if there was a third perpetrator, there's a very good chance that Terdoorn's final story, that his father had been involved, could be true. Terdoorn Sr. was a deeply abusive alcoholic. We know nothing about his criminal history, but we do know that many people in Boshof avoided him out of fear. We also know that he was so abusive that some of his children were removed from his care. The part of that version of the story I don't believe is that Hans stayed in the car. Hans Terdoorn was most definitely inside that building. There is no way he could have known everything in such detail if he'd been outside the whole time. I also firmly believe he raped Izzy Faree. So that is the scenario, if we believe that there was a third perpetrator. But playing devil's advocate, what if there wasn't? What if it was just the two brothers? Firstly, there's probably a far greater chance the girls would have gotten into a car with just two young boys and no adults. And if that was the case, we then have to decide if we really believe the story that Hans was the poor 15-year-old led astray by his 18-year-old brother. Of course, we have the benefit of hindsight now, and we also have the benefits, for want of a better word, of the knowledge that we now have of the severity of crimes minor offenders can commit. Since this murder, we have seen seriously violent premeditated murders, horrendous sexual assaults, family massacres, and mass murders committed by minor perpetrators, some even younger than Hans Terdoorn. We now know what people in 1966 and even 1984 to an extent did not really know or perhaps want to believe, that violence and criminality has no age limit. And you might say, oh Nicole, but it wasn't like that back then. Kids have gotten much more violent. And yes, you may be right to an extent, but you may also be wrong. Even today, minor offenders get away with crimes for many years because they're overlooked as possible suspects due to their age. And if that happens today, do you want to take a wild guess how much that happened in the 60s and 80s? So yes, I believe that a 15-year-old was entirely capable of committing a crime this horrendous. The question is, did he lead the attack, or was he really that influenced by his brother? I think the answer to this, for me at least, lies in what we know about Hunt's and Barent as people. Hunt's Teron, even back then in his teens, was known as a manipulative, charming, and smooth individual. His relationship history shows a darkly abusive nature and a lack of respect for women. His behavior in prison, bragging about the murders and then constantly lying and changing his story to suit himself, faking remorse for the families and the media, all point to a person with behaviors of an antisocial personality. Some might say a touch psychopathic. Hunt's Teron did not regret what he'd done. He regretted getting caught. And from that point, he did everything he could to push accountability onto other people. He had absolutely no qualms about getting two completely innocent men, one related to him, arrested to feed his schemes. In my opinion, this is a cold, calculated individual. And he didn't just become that way as an adult. And then we look at what we know about Barent Teron. Barent had lived with a disability his entire life, which he was clearly ashamed of, because he covered it up. He'd experienced bullying and low self-esteem around this, and he was described as a very withdrawn individual who didn't interact much with the world. Barent strikes me as a young man who was very unsure of himself. Possibly even the antithesis of his younger brother. The fact that Barent ended up taking his own life, for me at least, also tells a tale. Very rarely do individuals who commit these types of crimes become so haunted by what they've done that they take their own lives. And that's simply because you can't be haunted by something you don't regret. And you can't regret something if you don't have a conscience that functions like most of the rest of us. Of course, we don't know what other mental health issues Barent may have been dealing with, if any, but he was clearly self-medicating something toward the end of his life. And I, after covering almost 200 of these types of crimes, just find it really hard to picture Barent as the leader in this situation. Of course, we would often automatically assume that the older sibling would be the one in charge. And that's what Hunt claimed. But age doesn't account for the kind of power dynamic that can exist when one person is a predator and the other is looking for somewhere to belong. So that's my theory. If Hunt and Barent committed this crime on their own, I personally think Hunt's Teron was the dominant one and Barent was the follower. As for Hunt not being found guilty of murder, I think that's a tough one too. I understand our legal system is different now than it was back then, and we have far more precedents and case law to look back on. We also now have a very robust child criminal law system, which understands much more about how criminals evolve. However, I do think that Hunt could have been found guilty of murder by virtue of common cause. Common cause means that when multiple people go into a situation with a known possible outcome, everyone is responsible for that outcome, regardless of who pulls the trigger, so to say. By that principle, my question to Hunts would be, did you know your brother had a gun? Did you really think you were going to be able to rape two young girls and then just leave them alive when they'd seen your face? And of course, if you felt so afraid of your brother and ran out of that building when he produced the gun, when did you have time to draw on the wall with lipstick? At the very basis of understanding who Hunt's Teron is the fact that he admitted to raping Izzy Faree. And we know she suffered a horrendous sexual assault, as well as bites on her body. Does a 15-year-old who was only doing what his big brother told him so violently assault a girl that she suffers the kind of injuries an experienced forensic pathologist found disturbing? And if you really didn't want to do this, why, when your brother took Petra upstairs and you were alone with Izzy in that safe room, did you not just leave her alone? Your brother would never have known you didn't rape her. But instead you did. And you went much further than that. And that, for me, tells me everything I need to know about who Hans Teron really was. But as I waded through these theories and tried to figure out what seemed most true about these two brothers, something else struck me. We rarely see a crime of this magnitude as a first crime for sexual predators. This feels like something one would work up to rather than do on your first attempt. Unless you're being guided by a mentor of sorts who's done this before, like a father, maybe. And even if you do start there, we now know that sexual predators like this rarely stop. Barent Teron was walking the streets for another 11 years after this crime. Hans was in and out of prison, but even there we don't see any convictions for sexual offences. But of course, these were different times, and it was less likely that women would report rapes for fear of being shamed, especially women who may have been in some level of relationship with the perpetrator. After all, spousal rape was only officially made a crime just over 20 years ago. So, really, who knows what one or both of these men actually did over the years and got away with. It could be incredibly easy to get lost in all the whys and what ifs in this case. What if Hans Teron was a monster? And what if he essentially got away with murder? What if there were other victims? There's absolutely nothing wrong with asking these questions, but we shouldn't get stuck there. The Faree, Null, and Fushia families were stuck in the questions for 18 years. And for some, the inconsistencies and the unknowns continue to haunt them. But I think that Petra and Izzy deserve better than that. And Willem himself voices something I've seen many of the other family members allude to, that they cannot help but have some level of empathy for Hans and Barent because they came from such a terrible background. And although that's no excuse, I think the very fact that these families and its descendants still have it in them to express that empathy is testament to the power of the human spirit to overcome even the most terrible of things. Ironic, really. Their empathy for Hans, who had not been able to overcome, shows their own strength to do just that. The boys from a tragic background created an even more tragic background for so many other people. And finally, one of those descendants decided to turn that tragedy into something others could hold on to. Petra Null and Izzy Faree would be 71 years old this year. They would likely be mothers and grandmothers, or maybe they wouldn't if they chose not to, or if their lives took a different path. But they should have had the right to choose. They would have loved and lost and grown with their siblings. And there would be no podcast to listen to and no television series about their lives and deaths. But that's not what happened. Instead, their paths crossed with two, maybe three, individuals who had already internalized far more than any young people should have to. And three gunshots signaled the end and the beginning of a sequence of events that continues to echo through time 59 years later. I do wish that Andre could have been around to see his and his family's stories on the screen and in a podcast. But he was a practical man, and I feel like any whimsy and pride inside him died with his little sister when he was 15. And when I think about the fact that both the brother and the perpetrator were 15 years old when this happened, an image forms in my mind of a 15-year-old Andre and a 15-year-old Hans staring each other down across the graves of Petro and Izzy. Each young man making a vow that day, albeit to entirely opposite ends. One, to find the truth, and the other, to hide it. And now that we know which one was able to keep that vow, perhaps Izzy and Petro can rest and be remembered as they were on that last day, laughing, smiling, hopeful, eager, filled with the promise of a life unlived. Petra Nell and Issy Foree, rest gently. I'd like to end out this episode by expressing how grateful I am to have been able to collaborate on this project with CakeNet. It was an incredible honour to be able to help tell Issy and Petra's story, which also reflects so many of the stories of families of victims of violent crime in South Africa. I take my hat off to Willem van der Merwe for bringing this case back to life, so that thousands more now walk away from the series with the memory of Izzy and Petro in their minds and hearts. Sometimes the best way to honour those we've lost is to continue to talk about them and who they were. And I truly feel that this series, and hopefully my addition in the podcasts, has helped to do that too. If you haven't yet watched the series, Nichies, all 9 episodes are now available to watch on Catch Up, and I highly recommend you do so. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, signing out, and I'll chat to you soon.